So I think we're going to officially get started. The title for today is public pressure to enforce betin mulings. And in a way, this is part two of the chabura that we had a while ago, in which we were discussing the lumdus behind Shlichusayu Karavinan. The whole concept of Bati Din today are considered to be the hemshek or continuation of the Bati Din and the Dayanim of yesteryear, and we're giving all of the different svaros to explain it. So I wanted today to speak about the implementation of this idea of Shlichusayu in the context of a different discussion, and that is the discussion regarding the role of applying pressure in order to encourage and influence people to abide by Beis Din edicts and Beis Din rulings. I was just in Eretz Yisrael, and we had the annual conference of Dayanim over there. In Eretz Yisrael, things are a lot simpler in the sense that, to the extent that Batei Din have governmental authority in different areas, it's limited, it's not in all areas, but when it comes to marriage, divorce, when it comes to personal status issues, divorce cases, the Batei Din have official governmental jurisdiction. So if they want to implement a particular rule, they have automatic power on the part of the government. Even if parties don't want to be brought into the Beis Din, the Beis Din has automatic jurisdiction to drag people into the Beis Din and to issue rulings in the absence of a party showing up, as long as it falls within their jurisdiction. Here in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Eretz Yisrael, we don't have any kind of official governmental jurisdiction. The way that we enjoy jurisdiction, at least this, insofar as our rulings would be enforced, is through the arbitration statutes of secular law that state that if parties voluntarily submit to the jurisdiction of the Beis Din and they sign an arbitration agreement, so then when we issue a ruling, it can be enforced by either party in a court of competent jurisdiction, the same way that they would be able to enforce a ruling, for example, of the American Arbitration Association, if the parties would sign an arbitration agreement to appear before them. But if parties do not sign an arbitration agreement and the Beis Din issues some type of a ruling that is not capable of enforcement in secular court, the question is, how do we then have the ability to apply pressure for our rulings to be followed? So when I was the director of the Beis Din of America, there's a story involved here. This is going back about 16 years ago. So there were a couple of students who came to me. One of them lives right here in our neighborhood right now. He's not here at the Chabura tonight. But a couple of students at the time from Yeshiva University came to me at the Beis Din of America, and they said, you know, we really want to be able to help resolve aguna cases. We feel very bad that there are women who are agunot, where the marriage is over and the husbands are recalcitrant and refuse to give their wives a gittin. And we want to do something to help the cause. So I said, well, let's talk about it. If you really want to be of help, I'll tell you one area where I think that there's a lacuna. And that is that sometimes a Beis Din doesn't have jurisdiction. A Beis Din will summon a husband to appear because the wife wants to get, and the husband refuses to show up. He refuses to submit to the Beis Din or any other Beis Din, and we'll issue a seirah. We'll issue a contempt order against him. Or maybe we'll even hear the tainus of the parties, but it won't be a typical monetary case that can be enforced in secular court. It'll just be a get dispute where they're arguing about whether a get should be given. And the Beis Din will come to the conclusion that the husband is obligated to divorce his wife. We'll say chayav legarish, mitzvah legarish, nakon legarish, some sort of a formulation. But then the husband doesn't abide by our ruling. We're only a Beis Din in the sense that we can issue a ruling, we can issue a psak. However, we don't have the wherewithal to actually enforce our psak. Let's say, for example, that we would rule that it's appropriate to carry out hachakos to Rabbeinu Tam. Do you know what hachakos to Rabbeinu Tam are? Hachakos to Rabbeinu Tam mean the distancing measures of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam had a machlokus with the Rambam about if a woman says that her husband is repugnant to her, he's mayisolai, whether we can compel the husband to divorce his wife by beating him up. So according to the Rambam, you could coerce the husband to give his wife. Again, it's not considered to be a coerced get that would be invalid, thank you, as a matter of Jewish law, as a matter of halacha, because deep down, the man wants to do the right thing to do. He wants to, you know, follow the mitzvah, the Shema Debei Chachamim, right? So therefore, we have to beat out the Yetzer Hara from this man so that his true Yetzer Tov can emerge forth. That is, you know, the concept. Rabbeinu Tam, however, did not go for this. He said, no, just because the woman says, Ma'isolai, that's not grounds to actually beat the fellow up and, you know, take very harsh measures to convince him to give his wife a get. But you can institute in such a case distancing measures. What does that mean? It means that you can decree that we're not going to give the man an aliyah in shul. We're not going to appoint him to the board of directors. We're not going to allow him to be a member in shul. We're not going to invite him to our simchas. We're not going to transact business with him. We're going to make it very clear that he is not a member of good standing in the community. And if he then decides that in order to be a member in good standing again, he's going to give a get. So that would be a perfectly valid get. And none of these measures are viewed as coercive. The question is, why are the distancing measures of Rabbeinu Tam not viewed as coercive? A couple of theories behind that. One theory behind that is that when we beat a person up, or let's say we take away his money, those are punitive measures. We're penalizing the person until such time as they give a get. However, with respect to Chokos Rabbeinu Tam, we're just refraining from interacting with the person or giving the person privileges. That's only the withholding of privileges. That's not the imposition of a burden or penalty, but it's the withholding of a benefit. If you're just withholding a benefit, that does not bring about a problematic get. That's why, for example, Moshe Feinstein had ruled that the idea of the get law, at least the first get law that was passed in New York, was not problematic because all it did was withhold a benefit. It said if a man wanted a divorce from his wife, he filed for divorce, then he's not entitled to receive, according to the legislation, his civil divorce until he first gives his wife a get. So we're basically just withholding a benefit. There's no reason why he should automatically be entitled to the state giving him a civil divorce by taking away money from him or anything like that. We're just saying, you want a civil divorce, you want a benefit, you can't get that benefit unless you give your wife a get first. So that, he said, is perfectly okay. So that is the framework of Halakhos Rabbeinu Tam. Yes. Right, so generally speaking, we hold like Rabbeinu Tam. We paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. We paskin like Rabbeinu Tam that generally speaking, just because the woman says ma'isolai is not grounds to beat somebody up. Even if it would be grounds to beat the husband up, you do have to bear in mind the dina de machusa dina. If the law of the land says that it's a crime, so it's probably not a good idea to engage in that type of behavior. I remember once I was presenting at a conference, and they asked me the question whether we ever beat a man up, because the Gemara seems to indicate under certain circumstances, kofin b'shotin, you're allowed to apply pressure by using rods in order to beat a person up and do things of that variety. So my answer was that the vast majority, 99% of the cases, or I said really in my experience, pretty much all of the cases fell into the category where they were not justified physically beating a husband up. Those cases are very few and far between, where the halakha says you can actually engage in that type of intimidation. Therefore, if we would do such a thing, it would lead to an invalid get. And I said, in any event, even if you could construe of a set of circumstances where it would be legitimate according to halakha, you would have to be mindful of the criminal law limitations, that there are certain things that you just can't do as a matter of law. So the rabbi who was sitting next to me is a very renowned and respected rabbi from Brooklyn. Brooklyn's a different universe. So that rabbi said, Rabbi Reese is being very diplomatic. Let me explain to you exactly how we do it. And then he went into graphic detail about if you take a fellow and you clamp him down on a chair and you hold down his ankles and his wrists and you turn them enough times that it can be sufficiently painful that you'd be really surprised at how quickly you're able to get positive results in terms of how a fellow comes around. And I'm sitting there with just my jaw dropping because because I wasn't aware that people were actually really doing this. But I don't know what the justification would be, api halacha, because we basically paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. But I don't want to digress too much. So let's say that I don't think it was recorded. So let's say that, so therefore it's all right. Again, I probably misunderstood.
So, actually, sadly, you weren't going at it.
It's all. Let's move on. So, with respect to, let's say that the Beis Din decides that it's going to issue an edict, though, of Halachos Rabbeinu Tam, which are perfectly legitimate. So how then does it get carried out? Then the community, the communal leaders have to respect the Beis Din decision and say, oh, we're going to refrain from giving this person kibbutzim, inviting this person to our simchas, giving this person aliyos, allowing them to be a member in shul, giving them a seat on Yom Kippur, etc., etc. They have to actually carry out the edict. So what I said to the students was that once the Beis Din issues its psak, what really is missing in terms of a community mechanism is a group of people that go around and see to it that they put a pressure on the communal leaders and members of every single community to respect the Beis Din rulings and to carry out the various measures that have been recommended and prescribed by the Beis Din. So therefore, it would be very helpful if we had an organization that would function to try to be the enforcement arm, so to speak, of the Beis Din edicts. But I said that there are two different requirements, two different criteria in order to ensure that this be done properly. One is that you have to have a renowned posek who would be available to instruct and guide the organization as to what are considered to be proper measures according to halacha, so that whatever pressure is applied would be legitimate, and any get that would come about would be a kosher get and not a coerced get. You have to have somebody who is top-notch, who can really paskin on those issues, or a cadre, a poskim, who could paskin on those issues. And number two, I said, you need to have, you can guess what the other professional, you know, would be whom I recommended. You need to have a top-notch legal advisor who's going to advise you as to what measures are considered to be within the appropriate framework from a legal perspective, and which measures would be outside of the pale from a legal perspective, so you don't get into any legal trouble. And I recommended a posek for them. I recommended Rav Schechter Shlita, Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita, and I recommended a certain attorney as well, whom I thought was somebody who really cared about these issues and was also competent. This person went to both Rav Schechter and to this attorney, and they both immediately agreed to serve in this capacity, and thereby the organization known as ORA was formed. This is 16 years ago. That's how the organization known as ORA was formed. Organization of the Resolution of Agunot. That's how they got to their name. Very nice name. Since that time, in the past 16 years, this organization has been responsible for helping to facilitate the giving of a gittin in cases that otherwise may have been problematic, in probably over 200 cases. Every now and then I get emails from them in which they say how many cases it's been. I think that they're in the vicinity of 200, maybe more cases, which is more than really many of the other Aguna advocacy groups, because unfortunately, I don't say this to be overly judgmental or critical, but some of the other groups that were out there were really mostly focused on criticizing the rabbis and the Bate Din for not doing enough, but it wasn't as if they were necessarily really working on the ground and in the trenches to get the individual cases resolved. Some of them were looking for wholesale solutions that would be contrary to halakha, to just say, let's do away with the institution of gittin altogether, which you can't do according to Torah law, or to say, let's do away with the institution of marriage altogether, which completely defeats the purpose. It's throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, to say that here we are trying to promote and uphold the sanctity of marriage by ensuring that when a get needs to be given, it will be given, and instead they were saying, well, let's just have people live together outside of marriage. And it's not entirely clear, even if they would be living in sin, but in a context that looked like marriage, they wouldn't require a get anyway. So the various other solutions that were out there were much more problematic. So this was the proposal that was advanced at that time, and this is how that organization got created. But then the question becomes, what is the place or function or even the justification, so to speak, for having this type of an organization according to halacha. Now, what are the justifications and what are some of the pitfalls of having this type of an organization according to halacha? And this is where I want to fit this to some degree within the Shlichus Sayu discussion that we had begun, and maybe also give a few other angles. Yes, question.
So this might be a little bit of a side question, but so... Or I think one of the things they do is protest right in front of the person's house.
Right.
So how does that fit into Rabbeinu Tam's idea that you know withholding versus taking an overt action? How would that fit into?
Well, let's look at source number one. So here we have Avadya Yosef explaining how even though there is a little bit of a debate about whether Halachos Rabbeinu Tam are legitimate or not, you know, the other I mentioned. One justification is that it's a withholding of benefit as opposed to an imposition of penalties. The other justification, which is mentioned by the Vilna Gaon, it's found in the Maharik, is that it's not really coercion when you're putting this type of pressure upon somebody. That would be the argument that you're restricting their freedom of movement to some degree by constantly surrounding them with all these protests and things of that sort. So the Maharik says, well, the person can always run to a different town. They can always run to a different town, that if they don't like the way they're being treated here, they could go somewhere else. So then people could say, well, nowadays, maybe that's not true because word gets around very quickly. And wherever they go, people will know that they're subject to these measures and therefore they're not going to be able to escape it. And the counter argument to that, which of course, you know, many point out, is that actually they can escape it even in the original town because we're not so perfectly cohesive. And in any town, you can always find a group of rabble-rousers who will not necessarily respect the rabbinic authority, will have the minyan where they say, we invite and welcome all recalcitrant husbands. You come to our minyan and you'll be able to get shlishi every single week and you'll be able to be treated with great honor and therefore a person always has a place to escape. But how do protests fall into this definition? It's a very good question. You understand not giving a person aliyah, okay, withholding a benefit. You're not going to invite them to your Frankfurter roasts, okay, so that's withholding a benefit. We get that, right? But what about in terms of one of the other major tactics that has been used by Ora, which is organizing rallies and things of that sort, or even just threatening rallies, and sometimes they don't have to actually perform the rally because the threat enough is enough in order to bring the person into compliance. So says Rav Avadya Yosef, he's talking about where the ruling of the Beis Din that he was on was that a husband needed to give a get. He says, "Yamshik abal sees kesef tzoreres." If he's going to continue to draw a cold shoulder, and he's not going to conform with the psak din, so then you should apply the various distancing measures of Rabbeinu Tam. What are they? The Haina Sha'al Kalish Rishab Yisrael, that everybody should follow the following guidelines. The mana beitleit minudabim of cloud, they shouldn't speak to him at all. Shalasis lasis ima, they shouldn't transact with the person. Him in miska, whether in business, him in chomasamat and shemoman, any monetary matters. Shalachul achiv lashkoiso, they should not host the person or give the person food or drink. Shalavakul bakoya, if they're sick, they shouldn't visit the person. Shaloshila basic nesses, don't give the person a seat in the show. Koshkin shalalos to the Torah, and certainly not to give him an aliyah. Shalashalom akadish, don't even let the person say kadish. Koshkin shalalasis to the level of table, they can't dive in for the oven. Shaloshab shlomo, you can't say hello, how are you? It's pretty severe stuff, right? Wouldn't you agree? Shalaklokoklo, covered cloud, no covered whatsoever. Shalakik me, hello, me, kola efshah. So now, let's go into some of the broader global categories. To distance yourself as much as possible, shlachaisho, stalkono, don't renew the passport, okay, etc., etc., until the person gets the idea and they will soften up from their hardness of heart and from their stiff neck posture, the Ishmael of Komorim, and they'll listen to what the Rebbeim say, and they'll give the guess. So now take a look at the footnote here. So he says, that this was an actual psak din, says Rav Avadya Yosef. So he says that we also gave permission to Orech HaDin. We gave permission to the lawyer to do the following. The far same as Nusak Psak HaDin, to publicize as much as possible this psak din that we had issued. Bitonim Umodos, nor the newspapers in all of the public forums. To send around the word as much as possible of the Adias Yechidei Batei Knesses, etc., etc. In the Kadeshi Amdol and Mishma Bisuah Pesach Din announced that everybody will insist upon enforcement of the Pesach Din. So I think that if you read this Lashon, what emerges is that if you think about the function of demonstrations, this is really what the demonstrations accomplish. The demonstrations are a public manifestation of this message that we are removing from this person any sense of honor and any sense of a good standing stature within the community, and we're publicizing that to everybody. It is the ultimate act of itonim upar umodaos, of being mefarsim, the person's status as no longer being a member of good standing in the community. So I think that at least, even though it's not, there's no explicit discussion about hafganot, about, you know, demonstrations in the context of Chokos Rabbeinu Tam, I think that if you read the import of what all these measures are meant to create, and you also read what Rav Avadya Yosef is saying, that you have to be mefarsim in as much as possible, that's really, I believe, what the demonstrations serve to accomplish. Now, the demonstrations can take place in a number of different fora. It could be in front of the person's house, it could be in front of the person's place of business, it could be in front of a family member's house, if the feeling is that that family member is facilitating the individual's recalcitrance. But I think that this is how it falls within the Chokos Rabbeinu Tam. So one major function of the organization is really to be the implementing force of the Chokos Rabbeinu Tam. So what I wanted to add to this is that I think that from a Beis Din perspective, why should the Beis Din get involved in seeing to it that there be these types of institutions available in the community? So I think that there is a threefold fulfillment in this sense. One is a fulfillment of what we were discussing of Shlichus Sayoka of Dinon, of the notion that the Bati Din nowadays need to be functional continuations of the Bati Din of yesteryear. Number two, and I'm going to elaborate upon each one of these categories. Number two, the notion that we have an affirmative obligation to create not only Shoftim, not only to appoint Dayanim, but what does it say? The first Pasuk in Parashat Shoftim says, Shoftim be Shoturim, Titenlecha v'chol Sherecha. You need to appoint police officers. It could be the secular government, at least for the enforcement of monetary awards, but for something like putting pressure on somebody to give a get, where you don't necessarily have that avenue, so you have to create other avenues. You have to be able to figure out how to have shoterim in place.
Isn't that kind of what the New York get law did? It basically said, you don't want to give a get, fine, you're going to pay, what, $100,000 a day?
You know what? I think so. I think that if, to the extent that you can enact get laws, the people challenge the constitutionality of having that type of a law, and it's right now it's still in place, but I can tell you I don't think it exists anywhere in the United States other than New York. It's not the easiest thing to get past, and it also creates other conundrums, because to the extent that the law might go further than what the halakha would allow, that also creates potential get me'usa issues of having gittin that are suspect and questionable. Because get law number two did not have the haskama of a Moshe Feinstein. When it was get law number one, which simply said husband wants civil divorce, he can't get one until he gives his wife a get. So everybody, more or less everybody, it's never everybody, but most people were comfortable with that. But get law number two became much more problematic. So you were using the state as an enforcement arm, but in a way that was halakhically problematic. It said that, let's say the husband doesn't want a civil divorce, so only the wife wants a civil divorce. Most of the hard cases are those cases. The wife wants a civil divorce, the husband says, no, I want to remain married so I can continue to abuse you forever. So in that particular case, the get law number two says that even though the husband doesn't want the civil divorce, nonetheless, we're going to give him an incentive to give a get, because the judge should take into account his recalcitrance in terms of allocating the marital assets, so they can decide instead of it being 50-50, it'll be 90-10 or 100% to zero if he refuses to give a get, or ensuring that the amount of maintenance, or formerly known as alimony, that would have to be paid by the husband will be that much greater as a penalty, so to speak, for his refusing to give his wife a get. So a number of poskim, including Rosh Hashanah Zalman Orbach and including Rav El Yashiv, felt the get law number two was very problematic. So what's very important,
and
this
penalty?
Is part of the discussion, of course that's a monetary penalty. The monetary penalty is that the judge will say, even though normally the assets would have been divided 50-50, the judge will take into account the husband's refusal to remove the barrier to remarriage, that's the lashon of the get law, in terms of allocating the assets so that the wife will receive 100% of the assets instead of only 50% of the assets. That's taking away assets that would otherwise have gone to the husband, taking that away from him. So most poskim would say that if you take away something, like steal a person's wallet, you take money away from the person that they otherwise would have had, that's considered to be financial coercion. Financial coercion is considered to be coercion. It's a minority of poskim to say financial coercion isn't quite as bad. Maybe that's not considered to be coercion, but the mainstream opinion is that this is considered problematic.
The halachic prenup
is different. So some people are uncomfortable with that. The halachic prenup has two advantages. God. We're going the Inyan bill. So Inyan go, oh, it's okay. We'll hopefully come back to where we were. But it's fine to have a free-willing discussion. It's usually more fun that way. But the as long as we don't lose sight of our bearings. But the prenuptial agreement has two advantages. Number one, it's not really a penalty provision. It just says that a husband has to support his wife anyway. We calculate what's the amount of support that would be necessary to support a wife. Food, clothing, and shelter over the course of a year, which was calculated at $150 a day. When they're living together, so then the support just automatically gets paid, because when people live together, they see to it the food, clothing, and shelter bills are paid. But it says if they're ever separated, so we're going to quantify that amount of support to be $150 a day. So it's really just the fulfillment of the husband's support obligation as opposed to a penalty provision. If instead of saying $150 a day in lieu of support, it would say that the husband has to pay $1,000 a day, so then it would be more problematic. That's one advantage. The second advantage is the husband's willingly taking it upon himself. Now, some say that even if a husband willingly takes a knas, a penalty upon himself, that doesn't result, at least b'di'evit, in a get which is invalid. So if that was the only thing that you had going for it, that would be harder to justify, because not everyone is comfortable with that halakhic ruling. And some say, no, even if it's a penalty that the husband voluntarily takes upon himself, that creates a problematic get. That's a machlokis. It's all discussion in poskim. But what makes this much better is that it's not really a penalty provision. It's really a support amount that the husband pays. But yes, these are all important, issues. But you've highlighted, one of the problems of having a extrajudicial enforcement mechanism, which is that it's extremely important to monitor that it be instituted and implemented according to the halacha. So once it gets out of the hands of the rabbanim and the bati din and the poskim, then it might be an effective mechanism to cause a person to, give a get or do something like that. But if it's going far beyond that which the halacha permits, that's no longer being helpful to the bezdin. That's an extrajudicial force that's operating totally separate and independently from the existence of the bezdin. And that's not necessarily a function of shotrim or shlikusayo kavdinin or any of the things that we have mentioned. I remember with respect to the get law, I was part of a task force. This goes back 20 years ago. This is when I was first getting involved in the realm of Bati Din. This is 20 years ago. Mamish exactly like 20th year anniversary, probably, even a little bit longer than that. And we had a task force made up of members of Agudas Yisrael, made up of members of the OU. I remember the Bezin of America was there, the Akayama organization was involved, National Council of Young Israel, really all-star, cast of different representatives of Jewish organizations to try to figure out how to revise and to reframe the language of Get Law Number 2 so that it would be satisfactory to, at that time, Rabbi Yashiv. I don't think Shlomo Zalman was still around at the time, so that it would pass the muster of Rabbi Yashiv. And we worked together on different proposals in the language, and we sent it over to Rabbi Yashiv. We all worked with the assumption that if Rabbi Yashiv would be comfortable with it, of course the New York State Assembly would have no problem with our just, changing the language of the law, because, why shouldn't we be able to just change the language of the law? That was like a given. That was taken for granted. Rav Elyashiv looked at it and he wrote back to us saying, nice try, but, no cigar, and not sufficiently comfortable with this language, and that was the end of that exercise. But I remember that was one of my first forays into the Bezdin world of being on that task force. I was not officially appointed to the task force. I had a friend who was on the task force, and he just board meets at one of the meetings, and then one of the Aguda representatives took him out of the room for a moment, like, and said, "Who is this guy?" And, you know, who let him into the room? He said, "Don't worry, he's a good guy." And, you know, Baruch Hashem, I think that in the end they were comfortable with me. So, you know, we tried our best. Yes.
Can our chakos extend to family of the?
Yes, yes. You know, that's a question in general. Like when it comes to excommunication measures, things like that can extend to family members. The whole discussion, yes, no, maybe, but certainly if they are actively involved in facilitating the recalcitrance, what we would call the afkirusa de vedina, so of course they could be subject to these types of halachos as well. That's why we said that sometimes these demonstrations take place in front of the homes of family members who are facilitating the recalcitrance. Why not? To me, I think that's 100% legitimate. You know, the whole discussion, machlokes shachtaz, when it comes to Hilchos Nidoy and the like, is whether if a person has committed some type of offense themselves, whether we take it out on their children, that we don't let their children go to the school. So there's a machlokes because the children didn't do anything wrong. So you can understand there are two different viewpoints, yes or no. But here, we're talking about family members who are doing something wrong. So then it should be pashut, according to everybody, that it would be permissible.
This is not excommunication, what Avad Yosef described?
No, that's the thing. Exactly.
This is not a cherem?
Some say, come on, who are you kidding? That's the shock. And his Sefer Gruas Anashim says, this sure sounds like excommunication to me. Right. So that's why you have to rely upon one of two svaros to say, no, it's not quite excommunication. We didn't say that we're, you know, not burying the person in, you know, in the Jewish cemetery. We're stopping a little bit short of excommunication. Or, like the Maharik says, that the person can just go to another community where they're not going to be subject to all of these measures. This is only if they want to remain in good standing in this particular community.
So there was a case a couple of years ago, it might have been before you came to Chicago, where there was a case that ended up in civil court. The fellow tried to get it debated. He filed an affirmative motion to try to get the case in the Beit Din, and one of the parties wouldn't come to Beit Din, and the Beit Din eventually issued a siri.
Right.
And they went to the Rav of the shul and said, "That's nice. I'm not, you know, I'll talk to the guy when he comes in. Maybe I'll come in to leave, but I'm not going to tell him he can't daven here." Even within our own
microcosm
of the community, we're not seeing it.
Is exactly why when these students came to me and said, "What is it that our community needs?" I said, "What our community needs is really an organization that makes it their mission to go around to all of the shuls and all of the leaders and all of the community and all of the communal institutions, and to see to it that the Beis Din rulings are in fact respected and that they are appropriately implemented." So that is really what ORA was created to accomplish. And as I said, one of the major ways that they decided to do it was through these demonstrations, but with these controls that were built in. So let's review again. Yes. Wait, hold on. Before. Okay. I just want to review. We said that this could be... Right. I spoke about how the demonstrations work, you know, within the context and other actions work within the framework of Havchokos to Rabbeinu Tam. And then I said that why is it that there should be any type of a desire or any type of a an objective on the part of the Beis Din to see to it that there be these types of institutions out there. It's almost like the police force in Gotham City trying to create a Batman, right? You know, in order to help them with their work. And we know that it can be dangerous sometimes to have a Batman out there if they're not Bruce Wayne. You know, if it goes to the wrong people, you know, that sometimes it can result in vigilantism that might not be constructive towards proper administration of law and order. But I said, number one, it could be a kiyum on some level of shlichusayu. On number two, a kiyum of having shoterim. Number three, it could be a fulfillment of what we call klei hadayon. Klei hadayon, which means that the judges themselves are supposed to have enforcement tools that they put to use in order to ensure the fulfillment and the compliance with their rulings. It's the notion of having the shofar that they're going to blow to put somebody in cherem. They have the makel to whip somebody, right? I mean, and now the makel and the ritzua to whip somebody. So that there's this notion of, or even just to have a gavel that's going to bang on the table to make sure that there's order in the court. These are what we call the klei hadayonim. So in a way, Every single generation requires different types of clay hadayanim to be utilized by the dayanim themselves in order to ensure enforcement of their rulings. And number four, there's a notion of, and this really is applicable to community leaders, and it's also applicable to dayanim who serve in the function of being leaders of the community and framing proper conduct and behavior in the community, and that is right? That you have to have mechanisms where you're going to be able to give proper rebuke, proper tochacha to individuals in the community to understand, hey, Beis Din said something, you have to comply with what the Beis Din says. So I just want to briefly go through these different categories, and then maybe after we briefly go through these categories, we'll take some questions, okay? Because I want to cover the ground, if possible. We're not going to go through every single source. In terms of Shlichusaya, we've discussed that a little bit. There's a question about whether the obligation to set up Batei Din and Dayanim nowadays is Daraisa or Darabanan. The Ramban says that if we don't have smukim, we don't have dayanim who have direct smika from Moshe Rabbeinu, the obligation to appoint dayanim cannot be is not de'oraisa. The Sma similarly seems to indicate that it's probably not something that would be on a de'oraisa level. At the same time, Rabbeinu Yerucham writes in the Meisharim, Nesiv Aleph, at the end of Chelek Dalet of the Meisharim, Rabbeinu Yerucham, he says there still remains a mitzvah, at least the Rabbanah nowadays, that you cannot have any generation, you cannot have any community without a Beis Din. If it's not the Raisa, at the very least has to be the Rabbanah, right? Now, the Rambam doesn't really seem to say clearly that it's not the Raisa. The Rambam just says, Mitzvah Sesei Shaltar Lina Shofti Mishotim Vecho Bedina Medina Vecho Plak Plak Shenema Shofti Mishotim Titen Lecho Bechol Shearecha. There's no indication in the Rambam that nowadays it's only the Rabbanan. Said Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin in the Kol Kisri Rav Henkin Siman Sadi Dalet, he says Mashmos HaGemar Shemin HaTorah. Says the Tzmash of the Gemara that this is or still in the Tzvam, this is a Torah requirement even nowadays, and even Afilu Be'enem Smukim Lodun Api Mishpat Tzedek Upshara, even in a time that you're not going to have smukim, the Torah says you have to have a dayanim, you have to have some sort of a mechanism for law and order. So I think that how is that if you don't have smukim, so how is the mitzvah still d'oraisa? How can that be? If the dayanim themselves are not qualified d'oraisa, could the mitzvah be d'oraisa? L'chari the Ramban has a very good point. Rabbeinu Yerucham has a very good point. So how can you say the mitzvah nowadays is d'oraisa? So I thought if you look at the sugya and the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Pei Ches Amud Beis, the Gemara there talks about exactly our case, where Rav Yosef was trying to get a husband who was a recalcitrant husband to give a get to his wife, and he was applying measures that could be construed as coercion, coercive measures, right? And Abai said, how can you do this? We're not smukin anymore, so we don't have the ability, we don't have the authority. The Torah says, Ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim lipneihem, lipneihem lo lipneihem yotos, right? That's this week's parasha, right? That we need that level of, I need a tie into this week's parasha, my goodness, that we need that level of authority in order to be able to apply coercion. So he said, don't worry, it works through shlichusayo. What does it mean, shlichusayo? Most people understand shlichusayo means we're serving as the agents of the smukim who are in Eretz Yisrael, because at the time of the Gemara, you still had smukim in Eretz Yisrael. Comes along the Ketzos HaChoshen, I'm going quickly, Ketzos HaChoshen at source 6 over here, Simen Aleph, Sif Katan Gimel, we touched upon this earlier, which the Ketzos HaChoshen says, no, this sugi in Perek HaMegaresh, that's the sugi in Gittin, Ma'ivi Bizman HaZed Leika Mumchen, says it's talking about, this is the second to last line on page 2, Bizman HaZed Leika Mumchen, it's talking about not when they were Mumchen in Eretz Yisrael, it's talking about nowadays, it's talking about akin to our times, there were no Mumchen anywhere. So when Rabbi Yosef said, Shlichusayo Ka'avinan, he didn't mean like we think the Gemara Shlichusayo, that there were mumkin sitting around in Eretz Yisrael. It's like our Shlichusayo, like our Tosfos talks about over there. Shlichusayo de kamai ka avdinan. That he meant that we are the continuation of the Dayanim of yesteryear. So how does that shtikus sayom mechanism work? Is that deraisa? Is that derabanan? Mesivas hamishpat, the beginning of Chol Shemishpat says it must be deraisa, because if it would only be derabanan and you're going to compel husbands, you're going to use shtikus sayom to use coercive measures in order to compel a husband to give a get or to make a determination that you feel that it's not really coercive, but you're putting a lot of pressure. This could even apply to the halachos to Rabbeinu Tam as far as we are concerned, right? So how is that ultimately going to work? If I say that shlichus sayom was only derabanan, so then the get would not be kosher on a deraisa level. You would have to say something like afkino rabanan lekidushin mine. That we'd have to have some sort of mechanism which we say, well, we're going to just consider the original kiddushin through rabbinic force. To be considered like it never got off the ground in the first place. And that is something which we are very wary and circumspect about saying, that we're going to use that rabbinic fiat, so to speak. So, therefore, the Nesivas HaMishpat says, based on that argument, and also he says, and how would our converts nowadays be considered to be converts if our bat, we know that the Gemara says that a conversion requires a bezdin. Mishpat Sivbeit. I require a bezdin to perform a conversion. If shlichusai only worked on a rabbanan level, our converts would only be converts rabbinically, and from a Torah level, they would be non-Jews. He said, that is a completely unsustainable, that is a completely untenable proposition, therefore it must be that shlichusai works on a deraisa level. But how can it work on a deraisa level? The original appointers of the shluchim are no longer around. How can we be valid shluchim, valid agents, if the mishalchim, if the ones who are appointing us are no longer even alive? In fact, they've been dead for over 1,000 years. So look at the Rivash in Siman Reish Chav Ches. This is source number Ches over here, source 8. He says, you're right. Hadir minan. It's not a real shlichus. Of course, it's not a real shlichus. It's not, you know, intended to be technically serious in that sense. Rather, it means that with respect to those matters in which we're going to apply this concept, we make ourselves as if we are the shluchim. What gives us the right to make ourselves as if we are the shluchim? So he says, ukiilu bezdin. It says, if the Bezdin HaGadol, like the Sanhedrin, made this takana, it says, if they made the takana to Banhanu Mila Yuklu Lodim Mechak Mechutzum Aretz Belo Smicha, that the Chachamim outside of Eretz Yisrael and in all generations would be able to adjudicate without Smicha, it says, if this has been done. So what do you mean it says, if this has been done? Either it has been done, or it hasn't been done. Either it can be done or it can't be done. If the Mishalchim are not around, how could we really be Shlukim, especially on a Deraisa level? So I think the answer really is, we brought the case of Geirus. We asked, how can we have Geirim nowadays if Shlikusai is not Deraisa? How can the Bezdin function as a real bona fide Bezdin in order to convert people to Judaism, that it's going to work on a Torah level, that when they get married, it's going to other Jews, then it's going to be considered to be a full-fledged wedding, and when they have children, the children are going to be considered full-fledged Jewish children on a Deraisa level. How is that going to work 100%? So, with respect to Geirus, there's a pasuk, right? There's a pasuk in the Torah that says that v'chiyagorit gager b'sochechem l'doroseichem, that a ger is going to, you're going to be able to v'chiyagorit chem ger or Hashem b'sochechem l'doroseichem, just to quote the pasuk accurately, you're going to be able to have gerim in your midst l'doroseichem for all generation. So the Rashba and the Tosfos bring, you see a source 9 over here from Tosfos, they say the Dora Sechem Mashma Bechol Inyan Abagav She'ena Mumchen Alkoach HaKash Shaleika Mumchen Sherei Ein Smuchem L'Dora Sechem Mashma L'Dora Olam. It says the Dora Sechem, it sounds like we're always going to be able to have Gerim, and therefore it must be that the Bati Din will be able to function in a way that works on a Deraisa level, because the Torah promises us L'Dora Sechem. Just like the Gemara in Krisa says that nowadays a ger doesn't have to bring a korban, because the Torah says you'll have gerim l'doros eichem, so it can't be that a korban is me'akev the gerus. So too, if you don't have a Beis Din which is smuchen, it's not going to be ma'ake because it says l'dorosichem. So I would suggest that if we take this idea of l'dorosichem, we can apply it to understand what's going on with the nesivos and with the idea of the functionality of Bati Din in general nowadays. But we have a pasuk that says shoftim mishalchim titzen l'chol b'chol sherech. We pointed out pashus is pashus in the Rambam is this is a mitzvah d'oraisa for all generations. How can it be for all generations if we don't have smuchen? The answer is the Torah says you got to make it work. It's like that's what the Rivash means. It's like the Bez and Agada made this stipulation that there's going to be a hemshek. Even if we're not smuchen, we're going to be treated as if we are smuchen. There has to be a hemshek because you cannot have a functional Jewish society if you do not have a shoftim, you do not have dayanim who are fully empowered. And therefore, part of the mandate of having a Beis Din in every single generation is that we have to be able to apply this concept of Shlichus Sayu. If we have to be able to apply this principle of a Shlichus Sayu, so it also would follow that having that part of what we need to bring about is whatever mechanisms are necessary, such as having communal organizations that apply pressure for people to abide by the Beis Din judgments. If those mechanisms are necessary to ensure the smooth and functional ability of the Batei Din to be able to operate nowadays, so then that having those types of organizations becomes a fulfillment of this mandate of a Shlichus Sayu, to be able to have operative Beis Din mechanisms enables us to fulfill this mitzvah of having Batei Din that are able to service the community in every single generation. That's why we need Shlichus Sayu. So having this type of an organization, having these types of forces within the community enables us to fulfill Shlichus Sayu. Let me just go on to Shotrim, the other categories, and then we'll take questions, okay? I just want to make sure we cover this. Second, the next category is Shotrim. We pointed out that there's a mitzvah, Lahamid Shotrim. The Sefer Chinuch says like this, Shoftim, this is source Yud, right? What's our mitzvah? Limno Shoftim, not only Shoftim, but also Shotrim, Mishotrim. What do the Shotrim have to do? Sheachrichu lasos mitzvah satorah. That they will provide compulsion on some level, pressure, for people to follow the mitzvahs. V'yaksiva notim v'derech emes eleh ba'alkochem, and those who are straying. What does that sound like? The recalcitrant members of the community who are not falling in line, for them to properly fall in line. And to keep them away from things that are distasteful and are improper. And he says, whose obligation is this? Is this the obligation of the Beis Din? Is this the obligation of the Sanhedrin of yesteryear? Well, maybe Shlichus Sayu Kavdinim we view as an obligation that was effectively or constructively assumed to have been discharged by the Sanhedrin of yesteryear. What about the appointment of Shotrim? That's an obligation which is Hamutalos ala tzibor kulan shebechol makom umakom. That is an obligation that devolves upon whom? Everybody sitting around this table. Every member of the tzibor has this obligation. And if they don't fulfill this, then they have been mevatel, they have neglected, the fulfillment of this positive commandment. Now go on to the fourth line of the Sefer Chinuch. Very powerful statement that he makes here. You have to read the Sefer Chinuch. Even though we don't have smukim nowadays, they should appoint some of their, very good, well-intentioned college students, she'elahem koach al kulam, that will have the koach la'chricham l'chol minei hekrek she'ira b'neim b'mamanu apilu b'guf al-asiyas mitzvah satov l'mnoa mikir b'mkob dava miguna v'chol adom elo, that you will appoint individuals within the community to see to it that everybody does the right thing and that they follow the right path. So this becomes a part of that fulfillment of having Shotrim. It's very interesting. There's a Medrash Tanhuma, that says at the beginning of Parsha Shoftim, says Shoftim Mishotrim Titzen Lecha. Imein says, why do I have Shoftim Mishotrim together? To teach you, Imein Shoter Ein Shofet. If you don't have the enforcement mechanism, the police officers, you don't have a Shofet. Your Chaim HaKadosh says, if you're not going to be able to have the shochet, there's no point in even appointing the, even establishing Bati Din altogether, because they're not going to have not going to have any teeth, not going to have an enforcement mechanism. So others point out that it doesn't mean that the Or HaChaim HaKadosh didn't mean to be mevatel the mitzvah's essay of appointing Dayanim. He just meant that you have to, if you're not going to have Shotrim, then the obligation devolves upon the community members to figure out other mechanisms other than police officers that will be able to bring about compliance with the Beis Din edict. So that's the idea. So if you have a gap, you have a void, because of the fact that you are not able to fully utilize, say, the secular courts to enforce every single type of Beis Din edict, like this type of recalcitrance order in a Beis Din, in a Naguna case. So then you have to figure out, the community has to figure out other mechanisms that they're going to form in order to be able to accomplish this goal. I saw something very interesting. I don't know how many of you are learning Daf Yomi. You learn the Daf Yomi, okay, very good. So there's a Rashi on Daf Ches Amud Beis in Maseches Avodah Zarah that makes a reference to Parsha Shoftim. But he doesn't call it Parsha Shoftim. You know what Rashi calls it? Parsha Shoftim Mishotrim. He calls it Parsha Shoftim Mishotrim because you can't have one without the other. So Rashi understood that concept. It's very interesting. You find it right there. Okay, now, next we spoke about, so we have the responsibility that really came from the original Sanhedrin establishing this mechanism of Shtikusaya for all generations so that their power would be able to continue in all generations for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. Then you have the obligation on the community in each generation, that's the Shotrim. Then you have the obligation on the Beis Din itself. And that's what we call the Klei HaDayanim. It says in Asher HaMishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem. Okay, it's still the first pasuk of this week's pasuk. Ve'el mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. What's tasim? So the Gemara says tasim lifneihem elu klei hadayanim. These are the utensils used by the dayanim, as we mentioned, the makil and the ritzua. The ritzua, you're going to whip somebody. The makil, you're going to, you know, have a gavel on to bang on the table. The different tools that the Beis Din has to use in order to enforce its rulings. So the smak goes with Haigon. But Haigon says, so this is an obligation nowadays as well. There's a mitzvah. We established dayanim. We established Batei Din. So the Batei Din have to have clay of dayanim. They have to have their hammers, and they have to have their shofar, and they have to have their kalim in order to be able to implement the rulings and to be able to demonstrate their force. So the Sma in the first siman of Shulchan Aruch Shemishpat asked the question, wait a second, but it's not born in the Shulchan Aruch. So the Torah Shulchan Aruch don't bring this obligation to have Klei HaDayanim. So he says it must be because maybe the obligation is only when we have smuchim. Nowadays we don't have smuchim, since we don't have smuchim, so therefore there's no mitzvah of a Klei HaDayanim. So I saw in the Sefer Tzohar HaMishpat, a very nice Sefer Tzohar HaMishpat, it's written by, I think, a Lubavitcher, about laws of Choshen Mishpat. He brings, you know, different chakiros in every single siman. It's an excellent sefer because he even quotes me at one point, so you know the guy who's good. So in the Sefer Tzohar HaMishpat, he says that he thinks that maybe the right interpretation, and I like this, that maybe the right interpretation is not that there's no mitzvah for Klei HaDayanim. It's just that the old Klei HaDayanim aren't necessarily going to work now. Like the old Klei HaDayanim included a ritzua, that you were going to give somebody makos. We don't have jurisdiction to give a person makos. The reason it's not mentioned is because in every single generation, every single community, in every single situation, a Beis Din has to find different kalim that are going to be appropriate for them to be accomplish their purposes. L'ma'adah v'domeh, to what the Shelos Tshuvas Neos Desha talks about in the context of arbitration agreements. Back in his day, going back however many years, Neos Desha, Posek in Europe, so he wrote Simon and Aleph, that let's say I have two litigants who appear before the Beis Din, and one litigant says that I don't want to sign an arbitration agreement, a Shtar Biruin, because Halacha doesn't require that of me. I'm in front of the local, you know, official town Beis Din, and I'm prepared to do a Kenyan Suda. I'll lift up, you know, of an object of value, a pen, a handkerchief, a watch, whatever. I'll do a Kenyan Suda to abide by the Beis Din. So that's wonderful. The Beis Din will issue its ruling, and I'll say, I refuse to comply with the ruling. So they'll say, but you did a Kenyan Suda. He'll say, yes, yeah, so a nanana kish kish. You know, to try to get any money out of me because I did a Kinyan Seder. That's not going to be recognized by the governmental authorities. They could care less about a Kinyan Seder. So says the Neos Deshe, if somebody agrees to do a Kinyan Seder and they're not going to sign the Shtar Biruin, they're considered to be a Masaric level of din. They're considered to be refusing to submit to the authority of the Bezdin. You can issue a Seruv against them. Because whatever mechanism mechanisms the Bezdin needs to use to ensure the enforceability of its decisions, it's obligated to use. And you know who says this pretty much outright? The one who says this pretty much outright is the Shulchan Aruch Harav, the Baal HaTanya. Shulchan Aruch Harav Baal HaTanya and Kuntres Akon Hilchashkita Simen Alpha or Zion says, he's talking about whether the Dayanim are allowed to charge money for writing their Psak Din. Because you can't charge money to be a Dayan, but maybe this is something extrajudicial, you could charge money for it. So he says no, because the fact that they have to write their decision is because otherwise it's not going to be enforceable if it's not written down, and therefore this is part of their obligation. It says, Shechayavim, the Dayanim Achayavim, Litroach, V'lakuf Be'atzmam, V'kayim Apsak, Im Yesh Le'el Yadam Acharomos, V'niduyim, L'tzavos L'shotrim, Shezehu. This is Ika Mitzvah Sadayanim. This is the main crux of the mitzvah of the Dayanim. Kemo Shekastuv Shoftim Meshotrim, Mahatzil Ashuk Miyadoshko, to help the oppressed from their, rescue them from their oppression. Ein Lecha Mitzvah Rabba Kizu Shezehu, Ika Mitzvah Sadayan, Lakuf L'kaimo. That is the mitzvah of the Chotitzdiki and any machinations and the mechanisms they can come up with to Matzim Lameva Mechayevi Vechidim. They're obligated to do without charging any extra money. So he says this pretty much beferish. So therefore, if you're sitting at the Dayan's desk, so to speak, and you see that there is a lacuna, you see that there is some type of enforcement that's not happening, unless we're able to galvanize people of the community to form communal organizations, to do protests and things like that in order to influence and pressure people to follow the edicts of the Bezdin, then I think it becomes not only a responsibility of the Bezdin of yesteryear to put this in place, not only a responsibility of members of the community, it becomes a responsibility of the Bezdin itself, based on this notion of Klei HaDayanim. And finally, the last category, and then ask away. The last category, you two. I know you both have questions, right? Ari, you have one that you saved? Okay, I know that you do. Okay, that the last category is Hocheach Tochiach. Hocheach Tochiach is Amisecha. That there is an affirmative obligation, what we call mitzvahs tochacha, upon the leaders of the community to see to it that people carry out what they are supposed to do, api halacha. It's a lot of discussion. I was just in Eretz Yisrael. A lot of discussion about whether it's appropriate to have hafkanot demonstrations on Shabbos against Mechalei Shabbos. And this was a big issue even a number of years ago, when the feeling is that the Mechalei Shabbos are just going to become more hardened in their positions, that they're going to not necessarily come around because of the demonstrations. Do we say that this falls into the category of Kashem Sheh Mitzvah Loma Davar HaNishma Kein Mitzvah Shelo Loma Davar She'eno Nishma, like the Gemara in Yevamos, the Daf Samachay says that there's no point in giving Musa when people are not going to listen. So the Chazon Ish was confronted with that, and the Chazon Ish Rav Yashiv was confronted with this, and Rav Yashiv said, do you think that we are only trying to do the classical mitzvahs hafgana, we have more in mind than doing the classical mitzvahs tokaka, he said. We also have in mind that we cannot allow for Chilul Shabbos to simply go unchecked and unheeded. It's the obligation of the communal leaders to speak up and to make it clear that this is something that bothers them, that this is something which is just very, very bad. Now, you know who says something very similar? The Nemuke Yosef. So the Nemuke Yosef says that we have a stira. The Gemara in Yevamos says, don't bother protesting if you know that your protest will be unheeded. But there's a Gemara in Erchin that says that how far do you have to go when you give tochacha? Until a person punches you, until a person curses you, until a person gets really upset at you. So he says, it seems like even if the person's not listening, you're supposed to keep on going. So he says, it really depends on the context of what we're talking about. If you're dealing with an individual privately, so then you keep on going until they're ready to punch you or they actually punch you. If you're dealing with a public type of demonstration, a public type of protest, so he said, so even if the person's not going to pay attention, you should do it at least once. Now, why do you do it at least once? It's very interesting. And Mukhi Yosef's reasoning here is very, very interesting. And the Chazon Ish said that there's a notion, and you find this in the Ksav Sofer as well, that communal leaders have to just step up to the plate and make it clear that something is intolerable in their estimations, that they send a message to the community writ large. That's, you know, very important as well. And certainly when it comes to respecting the Besdin, that's an important goal. But the Mukhi Yosef said, even with respect to getting through the people, he said there are two different objectives as to why you would do this at least once. One, Mishum Dulai Yishmu. Maybe, you can never know for sure, this is the sugya, famous sugya, Mo Shabbos Dab Nun Hey, you can never know for sure that people are not going to listen to you. That's number one. And number two, he says, O Mishum Shlo Yei Lehem Piskon Peh, that people should not be able to make the argument that, what they did wasn't so bad after all. Okay? So, if you think about it, that really is an important, that is an important objective of the Hafganot, the demonstrations in this context. Ulai Yishmu. I can't tell you how many times I have seen the people who are recalcitrant, that when you do have the demonstrations, the threat of demonstrations, they come around. And just like the Rambam spoke about appealing to a person's better inclinations sometimes by reminding them of the right thing to do, so the demonstrations sometimes can really remind the person the right thing to do, and often it does lead to better behavior. But number two, Shelo Yei Lehem Piskon Peh, that you're sending a message to the community at large that when a Besdin issues an order, the Besdin issues an edict, it really means something. It's something that really has to be taken seriously, that it's not something where you just shrug your shoulders and say, Besdin ruled, but it's okay. Sometimes people will choose to abide, and sometimes people will choose not to abide by what Besdin says. It should be understood that this is something that has to be taken very, very seriously. The only thing that you have to be very, very careful about is that there not be any vigilantism. That when you have this type of organization, they really do consult regularly with their poskim, and everything that they do is coordinated with the Batei Din, that they don't jump the gun and start to organize the demonstrations and the like before there really is an edict issued by the Besdin in place, and they have to make sure that the edict still is in place at the time of the demonstration, that whatever they're doing is in accordance to the Ruach HaFakamim. So this is something that really requires a lot of balance, a lot of fine-tuning, and a lot of finessing, and a lot of vigilance and oversight, but I think that the rewards are important enough and great enough that it justifies the hardship that this entails for the Batei Din personalities to make sure that this never gets out of line, which is a constant avoda, but because of the urgency of having this type of mechanism and organization in place, I think that the benefits outweigh the risks and the challenges, as long as you make sure that you have, you know, God-fearing people who are involved and are at the helm. So before we conclude, I'll just, you know, take your question.
You mentioned kids in school. I'd say keep the kids in school. In general, we don't have economic coercion. Keep the kids in school, but you were getting scholarship. We can take away the scholarship. Something we give you. Right. Is that considered coercion?
Again, it goes to the question of if you're penalizing a kid because of the actions of a parent. So I don't know that it matters quite as much.
The father has to pay full tuition.
Again, but ultimately it's going to have an effect on the kids. So that relates to that separate question. Do you just focus on things relating to the parent, or do you also include the kid in terms of measures that are taken? So that's a separate machlokus. But here, with respect to the demonstrations in front of the family members, those are only family members who are, you know, facilitating the recalcitrant, so I think that would be much more justified. And, you know, our hope is that, you know, if these types of mechanisms, you know, are instituted, you know, properly, the gam kol am azeh, am kamori yavo v'shalom.
Tochiach still applies nowadays? I mean, isn't there the issue?
Yes, it still applies. There's a bare halacha that says that if you're dealing with mumim and not person, so then it might not be applicable because they're not considered to be am yisrael. But if you're dealing with public issues, so then Rabbi Yashiv says it's not an issue of okay, tochiach, it's an issue of just doing a public mecha'a.
Okay.
The public mecha'a. Some say that's a chelek of okeach tochiach. You know, so either you say it's separate or it's a part of it, but there is an inyan of doing that.